Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith, author, leading global finance blogger, and philosopher, America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Great. And today's topic is socialism. What is driving the majority of millennials to that? So we want to explore, you know, what's behind that trend, especially in the U.S. and in Canada. You know, what is socialism? Misconceptions on socialism. We'll look at different models like the Nordic model. How does that look, positives and negatives? And just in general, also how this could lead to increasing levels of political instability and even political violence in the coming months.
Right. And it's a great topic, Richard, because we all know that the younger generations, the millennials in particular, are publicly attracted to socialism as a more just system than what they see as unbridled capitalism, which in its current, you know, iteration has created extremes of inequality and opportunity. And so I thought we'd just start by laying out the 3 different sort of flavors of socialism, or what's commonly called socialism. In classical socialism, then that means that the state, the government, actually owns the means of production. In other words, the factories and the resources are owned by a democratically controlled or structured government, so that the rewards and the benefits from the means of production are then distributed relatively equally amongst the population. But in today's world, most young people, according to polls, understand socialism not by the classical ownership of the means of production, but by social welfare. In other words, the government collects taxes and it distributes it in some sort of fair fashion to the entire populace. And so I call that like the social welfare version of socialism. And in the Nordic model, the Scandinavian countries, which are often called socialist, but as you'll explain in a moment, that's technically not really true. But what they do have is they have a model of deep cooperation between between unions, you know, labor, big corporations, and the government. And so there's sort of a cultural social contract there that creates a more equal society, because the wealthy pay very high taxes and there's a lot of social welfare programs and also programs to create jobs.
Mm-hmm. And I think the millennials are coming to this from the social justice perspective. So they sort of focus on that first, and then they branch out into economics areas in terms of like socialism. Would you agree?
Right. Exactly. How do you achieve economic justice? And they're looking to socialism as the answer. But, you know, let's start with the Nordic model, because it's widely understood to be successful in these relatively small countries. And just, you know, I think Denmark has less than 6 million people, which makes it smaller than the inner counties of the San Francisco Bay Area, and considerably less than the county of LA. And I think Sweden is around 13 million people, something like that, which puts it on par with the county of Los Angeles. So these are really small nations in terms of their population. And so it's a lot easier for them to have a unifying culture than it is to have a very large multicultural nation like Brazil or the United States. But having said that, you mentioned a quote from the Prime Minister of Denmark, which I thought was really insightful about, you know, the Nordic model of socialism.
Yes, exactly. The Prime Minister of Denmark recently said, Denmark is far from a socialist planned economy. Denmark is a market economy. And yeah, just to further elaborate on that, the Nordic countries do not generally interfere with free markets. So they're promoting free markets. They're promoting free trade, globalization, and generally do not nationalize industries, do not subsidize favored industries, which is a common misconception.
Right. And I think they another common misconception is that they just give away a lot of free money to everybody. But in actual fact, they have very strong work ethic. In other words, a lot of their social welfare programs are aimed at retraining people and helping small businesses emerge and hire people. Mm-hmm. And so they're really focused more on creating jobs than giving free money away. And so that's why universal basic income, which a lot of people feel is the sort of socialist solution, in the Nordic countries, they're not really big fans of just giving away free money with no strings attached. They want to help people gain livelihoods. That's really their cultural focus. And you know, we were having a conversation about the cultural aspects of the Nordic model, and before we started recording, it'd be great if you could elaborate on that that topic.
Yeah, the first question I usually ask when people make reference to that is, have they been there before? And then I mentioned I've been to Sweden, I've been to Norway, and what I have observed in the nature of the people generally, in the culture, is a very strong sense of fiscal responsibility and a high level of education, making very efficient use of government resources, and even in the buildings they stay, generally not looking to build brand new government offices, but working in very frugally meager type of facilities, government offices, old buildings perhaps. And making the funds of the government go much farther in terms of very efficiently. That, I think, would be very difficult in North America, given a lot of the politicians are more concerned on getting themselves more lavish pensions.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And I had a chart that flabbergasted me, actually, that in the state of California, where I live part-time, the taxpayers' contribution to the public union pension plans there was less than $1 billion in the early 2000s, and now it's something like $45 billion. So the people kind of promoting social welfare versions of socialism, they're not attuned to the fact that socialism lends itself, if you have the wrong cultural traits, to cronyism and exploitation of the state rather than, as you say, a fiscally prudent use of state funds to help everyone. Mm-hmm. So that leads us, I think, to Venezuela, which pursued as policy both a classical form of socialism, meaning that they nationalized a lot of the industries in that country, the oil industry and so on. And they also instituted very broad social welfare programs. And so, but as we all know, the Venezuelan policies of the government have led to a complete collapse of their currency. It's trading at something like 300,000 or to $1 or might even be 3 million to 1 now. I'm not sure, but they've impoverished literally everyone in the country except those high officials and cronies who escaped and took their money to Miami before the currency collapsed. So that's socialism in one version of it. And then we really have to ask, what did Venezuela do wrong? Because they pursued socialism as most people understand it.
Yeah, exactly. And that contrasts big with between them and the Nordic countries in terms of their approach and what has resulted.
Right. And that government ownership of the means of production doesn't guarantee you any efficiency. And if the enterprise, whether it's owned by the government or owned by private parties, it still has to create a profit. It still has to be efficient. Otherwise, it just becomes a source of losses, and it'll take down whoever owns it. So, you know, Venezuela, I've never been there, but I have, sources there. I have contacts there. And it seems pretty apparent that the government-owned infrastructure and resources were very poorly managed, you know, that they were undercapitalized, you know, under investment, and cronyism has run wild there. And so that raises the question for millennials: well, how do you make sure that the socialist model that you find attractive is more like the Nordic model and less like the Venezuelan model? Because socialism as an ideology or as a way of organizing the resources and the means of production of the society, it's not one size fits all, and you have catastrophic failure right beside so-called success. So, yeah, socialism as a system is not the answer if it goes down the path of Venezuela.
Yeah. Just to point out a few more facts on the Nordic countries, that their countries were economic successes before they built their welfare states. A lot of people don't realize that it was the actual wealth that allowed the luxury of the generous programs that followed. So that's one fact. Another one is a lot of people don't realize is they don't have minimum wage laws in the Nordic countries. None of the Nordic countries have a minimum wage law. Another fact is in Sweden, they have complete school choice. So whereas your property taxes may go towards government schools only in North America, there's a choice in Sweden so that you could actually apply those funds instead to even go to a private school, to a private run school, if you think that's better for your children. So that a lot of people don't realize that. But yeah, the result, though, I mean, is it all bliss? Not necessarily. So if you look at what's happening now in the Nordic countries, there are problems, maybe not as bad as Venezuela, but in terms of the there's increasing racial tension, ethnic tension, especially from a lot of new recent migrants that are looking to capitalize on that welfare system that they have in place. They've also suffered recently from the oil revenues that go in mainly to Norway and Denmark, so that hasn't been as good. And a lot of people don't realize in many of those areas there's actually the highest consumption of antidepressants in the world. So that's a fact that is quite amazing as well. And then even recently what they've done is moved to do certain activities which a lot of people are not aware of, in terms of strong movements now to cut taxes, limit public benefits, reduce welfare spending. Pension savings have been partially privatized. For-profit forces have been allowed in the welfare sector. State monopolies have been opened up. So there's a lot of change happening even in the Nordic countries.
Right. Those are excellent points. And it goes to show that that what we're really talking about is not a purely economic system, that the socialism in whatever flavor we're speaking of is a social system and a cultural system. It's not simply a financial arrangement. So I just to kind of change gears a little bit and go through some slides I have about the social welfare model of spending on infrastructure and public spending as sort of like a way of distributing the wealth of the nation, right, broadly. And so I have a slide here of infrastructure. Everybody loves infrastructure, right? And it's a very politically popular way of creating jobs and distributing resources. And so we see that globally, China, of course, has spent huge amounts of their capital on infrastructure, you know, and we all know that they have high-speed rail and subways, and they've gotten a lot of public benefit as well as jobs from their infrastructure. But at some point, you've already built out all the subways you need and all the high-speed rail, and then you wonder, well, what do you spend the money on next if that's your social welfare program, you know, building infrastructure? And here in the U.S., it's well known that the U.S. infrastructure is aging in many ways. The water, electrical systems, roads, and so on all need more investment, and that can be seen as a productive use of public money. In other words, at least the public is getting some broad-based value and jobs are being created, as opposed to just giving money away without any strings attached, like universal basic income. And then to show another failed way of distributing funds, I have a chart here of higher education student loans in the U.S. And of course, we all know that there were no such things prior to the 1990s, and now there's about $1.3 trillion of student loan debt, which is guaranteed by the federal government. So it's a form of socialism that ends up turning students into debt serfs. So and a lot of people are saying, well, we need to forgive all that debt, but that debt was issued by for-profit firms. And so we have to be really careful when we talk about socialism, like who's skimming profits from these government programs. And then my last slide here is showing that state and local government expenditures, which tend to be the most, you know, boots on the ground, or the most visible forms of social welfare spending, tend to be state and local. In other words, infrastructure on local roads, local welfare, local school districts, and so on. And we can see that all in the U.S., the state and local government expenditures have soared at a rate of expansion far beyond the actual GDP, the domestic economy. And so then we start wondering, well, how are they spending so much more money than the economy is creating? And then the answer is, of course, we're going very deeply into debt. I mean, local governments are selling bonds, and globally you can see the tremendous expansion of government debt, as well as corporate and household debt. So if we're funding all of our social welfare and infrastructure with debt, then we're creating another issue that doesn't have anything to do with socialism or capitalism. It doesn't matter. the debt will creating a lot of imbalances and could bring down the entire economy. So people always love infrastructure and they love social welfare and they like the government spending more money, but where's the money coming from? And what are the consequences of using debt to fund social welfare?
Yeah, essentially putting the burden on future generations increasingly with the increase in debt.
Yes.
As the result. And then some would say, well, maybe we should just tax income on millionaires. But there's actually a fact that if you even put 100% tax on income from every millionaire in the U.S., that would only fund the U.S. government for 4 months. So that's quite an amazing fact. Another one is that even if you confiscated the entire wealth of America's 537 billionaires, that would not be enough to fund the nation's budget for even 1 year. So
wow.
There's simply just not enough money out there, but there's a perception that there is.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Richard. I believe the federal budget is pushing $4 trillion a year, right? I think it was $3.7 trillion, and so that's a big chunk of money. And I guess we're kind of coming back to the question of what's the downside or the risks of pursuing a socialism. And I think if you're going to follow the classical socialism of the government taking ownership of the means of production, then you risk gross inefficiencies and cronyism, mainly insiders basically pillaging those assets to their own benefit, and then impoverishing the nation by underinvesting or malinvesting the state money. Yeah. That's one danger. And then in the Nordic model, you've described that it's not, it may not be affordable, you know? Yeah. Right. Yeah. As revenues decline, then even prudent governments end up starting to borrow money and living off of asset bubbles as a way of generating their revenues. So that's a danger. And then the U.S. model of just borrowing trillions to pay for infrastructure and social welfare programs, that creates a really great risk of a currency collapse or a loss of faith in the entire financial system.
And I would go further to that. If you look at the history of socialism and the evolution of it in particular countries, generally there's a very strong decrease in the standard of living that ultimately results in brain drain and wealth drain. So you get to a point at some point where it's nonlinear. A lot of people begin leaving, looking for opportunities elsewhere if they're educated. Wealthy people don't sit there as sitting ducks. They're likely to move at some point together with their wealth, you know, to somewhere else. So that's also the potential for that to happen, brain drain and wealth drain.
Yeah, and my last point, Richard, would be that, you know, socialism, like capitalism itself, however you want to define it, it tends to work much better when things are decentralized, when power is decentralized, ownership of assets are distributed, and people have a say, both as consumers and owners. And so my example here is water systems. In other words, if in very localized places like a city or a county, public ownership of water has been very successful because the agency's localized. They're owning specific assets in the community, and the community is democratically organized, so they have a say about how that resource and asset is managed. And they can vote out the board if the board is corrupt or incompetent. And so a socialism on a very small decentralized scale can work very effectively in protecting or public assets in the same way that capitalism really only works if there's if competition is allowed to thrive. And so we're talking about when things are at very large scales and centralized power, then you get rid of competition, and you also usually get rid of the benefits of actual public ownership of assets.
Mm-hmm. And I think overall, the majority of millennials have not been able to understand how and why there was a financial crisis back in 2008, 2009, and what the role of the Federal Reserve and central banks in general has been in causing that, as well as in causing wealth and income inequality from various central bank activities and central bank policies. We've covered that a lot in prior podcasts, how and why that happens. So that I think that's been also a major driver for the millennials to sort of misunderstand what's happened and therefore go to maybe bad conclusions, if you will.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Richard. The financial repression of zero interest rates and quantitative easing for the banks and so on. Yeah, that's what's disrupted and the opportunities and created the inequality that the millennials want to resolve. And we understand their desire and the justice of resolving those inequalities, but it's how do we do that? And if we're going to pursue the Nordic model, then what we're really talking about is then you need a market economy and a cooperative government and a cultural milieu that supports fiscal prudence and wise investment of resources, not just like throwing money away and giving it away and yeah, borrowing
exactly. it. Yeah, exactly. This there was also a recent study I saw where it was pointed out that the minority of radical leftists are actually dominating the Democratic Party agenda. So this is interesting because between the Democratic Socialist Party of America and the traditional Democratic Party, which is now having their agenda controlled or dominated by radical leftists, this is quite disconcerting, you know, in terms of what could happen for the potential for extreme socialism in America.
Right. And again, what we're trying to elucidate here is that there are models of like private or public ownership of assets on a small scale, like I said, that have a long history of functioning, like public ownership of the water works. But what's being proposed is not really classical socialism. What it lends itself to free money for everybody, and if we have to borrow the money, then fine, you know. And so that's not really socialism, and it's not classical socialism, nor is it the Nordic model that so many people look to as a successful model.
Yeah, exactly. And we're essentially in general agreement to conclude. As some final words in terms of what could make sense. So we don't take sides on any parties, but politically, but generally we see a more limited government approach that is decentralized with minimal special interest group lobbyists, if any at all, that lends itself from a centralized form of government as being optimal, right? Would you not agree in terms of that approach?
Yeah, absolutely. That a planned economy is a failed economy. That's really what we're talking about. There, you know, a planned economy means insiders benefit and it's lost to all of its adaptability, flexibility, and efficiency.
Exactly. And what do you see as potentially evolving as a final question to consider in the coming years in terms of the evolution of where America is going?
Well, that's a big question, Richard. And certainly people are struggling to find some sort of answer to rising inequality and the concentration of wealth and power. And they haven't really come up with anything. And so a lot of millennials view socialism as the answer. And other people view like reforming the government so that there's less cronyism and so on. But I don't think that that they're going to get the results they want from those kinds of policies. You know, I think we need a radical decentralization of power and a radical redistribution of opportunity. And that's going to mean breaking up all the cartels that are, basically state-managed cartels, which control most of the U.S. economy. So, and get rid of the financial repression that we've described. It's totally centralized, and it benefits centralized wealth and power.
Great insight, Charles. We'll end it on those words of wisdom. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com, and you can read the first couple chapters for free of my new book, Money and Work Unchained.
Excellent. We'll end with you. Thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only. and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.